Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the first of our budget work sessions. All the council here and most of our budget advisors, thank you for your continued service.
Aggrandizing way as conscript fathers. And so I think our budget advisors are our conscript mothers and fathers who have conscripted themselves to the public interest to wade through a huge amount of information and help us make good budget decisions. So thanks for your service, and we appreciate you. So before we proceed with Andrew's presentation, I guess I just have a couple of points I'd like to put on the table, and then some others later as we get into some of the specifics here of the packages in front of us. I think it's important to remember why we're here at this juncture with a general fund budget that is stabilized and with just a skosh of additional resource available. It's really because of the prudent decisions that this council made in the last budget process, in which we were cutting the general fund budget, but then took the results of those cuts plus what our bureau managers had done in good management of bureaus and expenditures during the second half of last year, and using the resources in the fall month to pay down debt, as you may recall. That resulted in about a $2.5 million improvement in the general fund forecast, as Josh will talk about here today. So the fact that we were diligent and prudent, good old-fashioned words that I think actually apply to the decisions that this council made in our work on the budget last year, means that we're in a better place this year. And I'm happy about that. And I feel like we've been validated in the work that we did on this budget last year and in the work that we did on the fall bump. So I just want to commend and thank everybody for that. And we've got a splendid misery this year of trying to figure out how to spend a little bit more money. Would we love to have a lot more to spend? Oh, yes. And I think there are going to be some opportunities for the council to exercise that same kind of long-term view in some of the decisions that we make in the next few months that will improve our budget picture even further in transportation in particular, but also in urban renewal and other areas. So we have a chance to continue that kind of long-term careful stewardship that put us in this place at the beginning of this budget process. So with that, any other comments from my colleagues before we
turn it over? I just want to say the mayor has offered the first hint of his priorities this budget season. He did mention transportation first. So it's caused a little anxiety at this end of the table, but we'll see how that plays out.
And I also want to comment that there were several things that we one-time funded last year because we didn't have the ongoing resources. So I'm not sure that it is accurate to say that it's a stabilization budget because we still have a lot of one-time programs that we value that are at risk. So it'll be interesting to see when we get the final forecasts if we were to put everything that we one-time funded into ongoing. Yeah. Is that even possible this time? But we had started that a couple of seasons ago in looking at, there used to be a Christmas tree of one-time fundings in previous administrations, and I think that we have over many years been correctly putting things into ongoing that really are ongoing, and I hope we continue to do so.
Good point. Other comments at the outset here? All right, so Andrew.
So thank you for the introduction and comments. I believe it's on.
I think Carla has to do that.
We're going to have a series of work sessions this week, and you should all have the schedule, sort of the updated schedule that came around last week, and it should be in your binders. These work sessions are topic-focused, and this is a different way. In the past, we've done these by bureaus, but again, sort of given the stabilization budget and the financial forecast information that Josh is going to share with you, we, in working with the mayor's office, decided that sort of topic areas would be a good focus this year. And we've structured them around the three priorities that the mayor put on the table in terms of homelessness and hunger and complete neighborhoods and emergency preparedness. We've also added sessions in there for special appropriations, technology, equity, economic development, and citywide infrastructure. And so, again, those are scheduled throughout this week. We have sessions every day through Thursday. The format for these, everyone's going to be at the table. We're going to have bureau representatives at the table, and we're going to have all the bureau representatives that have those packages at the table. So again, the idea is to have sort of that roundtable conversation about the topic area as a whole. The bureaus will have a few minutes to walk through their requests and explain sort of what they are requesting as part of this budget. And they might have provided some supplementary information as well, which should be in your binders. But again, those presentations are expected to be brief. And really, the process is supposed to be sort of an interactive process with questions. And so again, the bureaus have an order that they can go in. But to the extent council wants to pull something out of order, wants to spend more time on one issue, less on another, that's your prerogative. And we've sort of scheduled with a little bit of spillover time as well in case it's needed. You should also have received a sort of consolidated decision package tracker, which I know is one of those documents you look forward to receiving every year. And this is all of the decision packages that were submitted as part of the requested budget, and they've now been broken down into the topic areas in which we're going to be discussing them. So they don't flow in quite the order that we're going to hear them in, but you can see the citywide infrastructure, complete neighborhoods, economic development. So you should all have a copy of that as we go through the week as well. It should have been right, I think, on your at your place when you came in. We have additional copies if needed. Great. The total ask is 32, a little over 32 million, and that's one time and ongoing combined. We are. So Josh is going to give us numbers in just a second. I'm just going through process stuff. And then, again, the goal of this being to have that sort of overall conversation about each of the topic areas and really begin to focus, as the mayor said, on how to allocate the small amount of excess general fund that we're currently forecasting, obviously with the final forecast coming out in just a few weeks. This is also, these work sessions are also council's opportunity and the Citizen Budget Advisor's opportunity to ask for follow-up information from the bureaus. So to the extent you have questions, and it can be questions about what they have put in front of you in terms of requested budgets. It could be other questions that you have as well about those bureaus. Either questions for the bureaus or additional research that you'd like the City Budget Office to do, now is a good time to do that so we can go ahead and get those requests in and get those responses back to all of council. The last thing I will mention is that at the beginning of the three priority topic areas, again, the homelessness and hunger, complete neighborhoods, and emergency preparedness, we will also be talking about what we're calling the priorities to performance project, which is a focus on performance management. And so I'll go through that a little bit more when we get into the housing session, but we'll be doing that at the beginning of each of those three sessions, sort of spending a few minutes talking about setting some performance metrics in those areas. Any questions about logistics for this week? Okay, with that, I'll turn it over to Josh just to recap where we are at this point.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. When I was back in front of you back in November, I think it was Commissioner Fish who coined the term the Saltzman Principle that generally said that the April forecast would be better than December. Since then, the budget gods have conspired to make this a year where that is unlikely to happen. there is still time. Yes. And I appreciate that, and I hope, in fact, he is correct. And the truth is that between now and the end of April, in addition to updating our normal forecast models and that kind of thing, obviously what we're concerned about is business license taxes. At this point, last year, we had gotten in 35% of our business license taxes for the entire year. So we've got about two-thirds of the collection still to happen. So we're talking about both in volume and numbers of millions of dollars can swing the forecast quite a ways. But also we're talking about a very small number of taxpayers. I mean, relatively speaking, we're talking about in the hundreds of taxpayers. And so it's tough to know until literally about 3 weeks from now when we get those checks and see how much they owe. But as it stands right now, we provided a March update about 4 weeks ago that gave us $3.6 million in new ongoing opportunities and $2.4 million in new one-time. And so that's where we're sort of our jumping off point for the business license tax discussion as well as picking at the edges of other things. Yes, $3.6 million in ongoing and $2.4 million in one-time.
And is that net of the COLA for next year?
Yes, it is. That includes, the March update included changes to the COLA as well as a couple of council actions that also allocated some funds, particularly to parks, comes to mind.
Well, Mayor, I guess those numbers beg a question, which perhaps we won't resolve today, but just would look for some guidance. If we don't see a change in the forecast, we're looking at 20 cents on the dollar in terms of the asks that are before us. And I wonder whether we want to give some thought to how to calibrate expectations, because we're going to be going out to the public seeking feedback. And it may very well be that there is, among this updated list, things that have a supermajority of council interest that fit within the priorities we've established for this budget and that have a lot of political support, community support. Absent some prioritization following this week's process, I just fear we're going to go out to the public and give people the impression there's $30 million in play and have lots of great testimony, but without giving them sort of a way to handicap how we're likely to approach some of these things. Now, there has been some discussion about seeing whether it's you got 3, 4, or 5 votes for certain things at the front end that we would essentially say are part of a package or some other alternative. I'm not advocating a particular approach, but I am sensitive to the fact that we're going to have lots of people coming out when they see this list thinking there's something on here that they want to advocate for, and we may lose the forest from the trees. So just food for thought.
Good point, and Andrew spent some time and his team spent some time thinking about how to configure our public sessions so that we inform people about the reality that we're working with, maybe even a little better than we did last time, though I think we did a good job last time. So your continued thoughts about how to do that in a way that engages the public but doesn't set either the citizens or us up for a whole bunch of dashed expectations, great. The more the better.
And Charlie, is it our intention to have facilitation like we had for the rate hearing?
I
found that,
like that
so
idea.
Successful.
I think that was helpful. I do too.
Also, yeah. I think the skilled facilitators were good at taking the temperature of the room on some macro things, and that might also be a way to kind of get a sense of, in advance, if the people are there for what broad categories of interest, and to the extent people can't testify, taking the temperature of folks. But I thought the facilitation at our last public hearing made a huge difference, so I hope we can build on that.
Sounds like there's consensus about the value of that. Good. Thank you. Thanks, Nick. Okay. Other questions or requests of Josh in particular or Andrew and his team? Other than, let's hope the Saltzman principle isn't just a one-year affair or most years affair, right?
Yeah. 15-year affair.
Well, he's always been right on the downside.
Yeah.
Dan's principle has always been applied to the downside, which is it's never as gloomy as it's presented. Now we're trying to see whether it applies on the upside.
We'll see.
That's a twist.
We'll see. Let's hope. Okay.
I did want to ask, was it Matt Damon who was the star of the Saltzman principle? Is that
No, will be. All right. Good. Then let's take the first
Great.
Section.
Yeah, so with that, I think we'll move into the homelessness and hunger session. So we'll get the Bureau representatives to the table.
I can just
Commissioner Saltzman has some comments at the beginning.
Yeah, I'd just like to welcome everybody, and as we talk about the key budget priority of housing and hunger, I want to invite Tracy Manning, the Housing Bureau Director, and Lisa Pellegrino, the Director of the Portland Children's Levy, to come forward for a few introductory remarks. I think you're all familiar with the work that the Housing Bureau does. You'll learn more about it, but it's very involved in dealing with issues around homelessness, and that's one of our, as a priority reflects. But you may not be as familiar with the Portland Children's Levy, which, thanks to voter renewal last May of 2013, added a new investment priority, which is childhood hunger relief. So effective this July 1st, the Children's Levy will be the biggest player in childhood hunger relief in the city. We're going to be investing almost $1 million a year in programs that are going to alleviate childhood hunger. So I thought it was important, even though we haven't made the actual decisions as to which organizations we're going to invest in yet, we will be doing that by July 1st. So I thought it would be important to have Lisa give us just a little preview of that as well. So I think we'll start with Lisa, and then we'll go to Tracy.
Just push the little button in the base of that microphone there, Lisa. It should stay lit, but...
It's not staying.
There you go.
So as I think you're probably aware, childhood hunger is a pretty prevalent problem in the city. And when we were first doing our look-see to kind of understand what the local data scan was, we took a few facts into account, which I'm not sure to the degree to which folks are aware, so I thought I would kind of bring those up. So first, about a quarter of the children in Multnomah County, so a lot of the stats are from Multnomah County because we don't have them by the city, are deemed food insecure, which means that they have disrupted eating patterns or have to skip meals. About half of the children who are age 0 to 4 in the county participate in the supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. So that's what is commonly known as WIC. So that's half of all 0 to 4 year olds. That's substantial. About a third of children age 0 to 17 in the county receive benefits from the supplemental nutrition program, assistance program, which is now known as SNAP, and used to be known as food stamps. So that's a third of all kids in the county. And then a little more than half of the kids who are attending Portland Public Schools, or I should say city schools, including the other districts in the city, are eligible for the federal free and reduced lunch program. So it's a substantial issue in the county and in the city. And the schools serve, you know, on average about, just to give you a sense of numbers, about 38,000 meals, free meals a day currently. The Oregon Food Bank, also, which sort of tracks local statistics, reported that about 34% or a little more than a third of the kids, or a third of the people who are eating from emergency food in the county. So this is donated food. This is not a federal program food. Were children in an average month. So it's a substantial issue. We're hoping to be able to put some dent in that with our funding. As Dan said, when the voters renewed in May, hunger was included, and so we have now RFP'd out for folks who want to come and address this issue. And we're going to put about $2.6 million over 3 years. And so we went out and did pretty extensive public input on thinking about what sorts of things do we need in our community to address hunger that aren't already happening. So the stuff that came back that sort of formulated into our strategies for funding this time around were the following things. So folks thought we should increase access to and utilization of the existing hunger relief programs that we have in the community. So that's a lot of the things I just discussed. So how do we get more people to those resources, and how do we get more people enrolled who are eligible? Because not everyone who's eligible is taking advantage of it. So that's sort of the first strategy. Second is to increase the number of school-based food pantries, particularly in North and East Portland. So that's become a strategy that has been rolled out, I'd say, over the last 5 to 7 years. Folks have really concentrating on putting pantry resources in schools because it's easier for families to get there, and the hours are more, folks are coming there anyway. They don't have to go to a separate location, and that's significant in terms of being able to reach people better. Third is increasing access to food during the summer and other out-of-school time. So as I said, a lot of kids are getting fed at school, but when school's not in session, that doesn't happen. So there are, through the Parks Department, as a matter of fact, there's a number of summer feeding sites, and then there's other folks in the community who are doing summer feeding. And that was, what we heard loud and clear is we need to particularly address high-poverty areas of the city where there is not current summer feeding. So that's a major priority. And then the other sort of catch-all category was to look at alternative and innovative strategies to either, increase the reach of the number of folks that we're reaching with hunger relief services, or to increase the nutritional value of the food that we're already providing for people. So there's sort of a, if you've got an innovative or a different approach, you have a category to apply for funding in. So all the applications are in at this point. We've had 12 organizations come forward, and some of these proposals represent partnerships. They're not just one organization. In fact, all of them, I would say, represent partnerships of some kind. And they are currently being reviewed by groups of volunteer reviewers. And the committee, as Dan said, is going to meet at the end of May and make decisions about what to fund. But either way, we'll be looking at investing in around a little more than $2.5 million over 3 years to address this issue. So okay. I don't know if anybody has questions, but that's it. Okay.
Thanks, Lisa.
Just one question, maybe just a little more of an elaboration. Could you elaborate a little bit more on how those issues, particularly access to programs and pantries in schools, how that interconnects with the Sun Schools program in particular?
Yeah, I mean, all the pantries currently that are operating are at Sun sites because they provide essentially the infrastructure there to be able to offer staffing, to have staffing to get volunteers to staff the pantries, because usually those are staffed by not paid people. So currently they're all at Sun sites. And I think I haven't read through all the proposals yet, but the ones that I remember were basically to expand pantries at Sun sites.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
Thanks,
So are there any opportunities for the children's levy to pick up some of the other priorities? I know that we've had some discussions about the Sun Schools, but you have some additional resources this year. Is that correct?
I didn't touch it.
Yeah, okay. They work in mysterious ways.
I know. It doesn't like me. Yes, we have a specific sort of pocket of funding for increasing the number of Sun sites in the county, or in the city, not in the county. And we should be able to expand, my guess is sort of 7 to 8 sites in that range.
Is there any other capacity in your budget for helping with some of the priorities like youth homelessness?
I think a council special appropriation for new PA system may be rising on the list.
I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Put it this way, we fund a lot of services that support kids that are homeless, but we don't specifically fund into the homeless youth system, if that makes sense. So we provide child abuse prevention services, we provide after school services, we provide mentoring services. Those serve kids who are homeless, but they are not necessarily directly funding organizations whose main purpose is to provide homeless youth programming.
But that was my question. Is there any capacity to do that, to help out with some of the other priorities, given that we have far more asks than we have money?
I would say the children levy right now has 3 times the number of asks than we have money to invest as well.
Yeah. We've had requested almost 3 times the amount of money that we... we are bound by the ballot language to fund with...
Yeah.
Sorry. But we are serving substantial numbers of homeless kids. So that's the only thing I'd say. Thanks.
Okay. Tracy Manning, the director of the Portland Housing Bureau. Thank you, council and citizen budget advisors. So we were asked to provide some landscape on the priority issue around, specifically for us, around homelessness, less about the Bureau itself. So just a few things that will hopefully set up the rest of the discussion well. I think it's of no surprise that the landscape of homelessness has been rather daunting in the last few years. At our last count, there were 2,869 people on the street or in shelter, and that's a 5% increase over the count that occurred 2 years prior. In both counts, people of color overrepresented in homelessness. And then in addition, last year, Portland had the second lowest vacancy rate of any metro area in the country at 3.1%. So what that means is people are still clamoring to move here and creating a lot of upward pressure on rents as the vacancies decrease. That said, we remain optimistic that we have some new opportunities to try to impact homelessness. So to start with, I'll foreshadow a bit of what you'll hear from Nan Roman. Nan is a highly respected, she's the president and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, and she's speaking at City Club this Friday. And one of the things that you'll hear from her is that homelessness is a crisis, but it can be solved, and we know how to do it. Sneak peek, Commissioner Saltzman's target initiative this year to house homeless women. We're 5 months in, and our talented community nonprofit partners have already outstripped the outcome expectations that we had of that relatively small program, exceeding those annual targets. And they've housed 109 women in 5 months using techniques and partners we already have. Nan will also share that ending homelessness takes both an urgent and a united response. Every year, we all try to work harder and smarter and to be more efficient. This year, thanks to the work of the mayor and Commissioner Saltzman with their colleagues at Multnomah County and the city of Gresham and Home Forward, we will be. So next week, they will bring to you the charter for a new governing board that will coordinate our community's collective work on ending homelessness. As an example, I would give you the fall bump process. Commissioner Saltzman and then Commissioner Kafoury convened a group to talk about the needs of homelessness in our community, regardless of whose responsibility those people were to serve. And as a result, City Council passed a $1.7 million one-time-only general fund request to end the homelessness of the most vulnerable people on the streets, both families traditionally served by the county, and disabled people more often served by the city, including those with frequent contacts with public safety. So in 2 weeks, you'll hear the first Home Start Outcomes report, as well as about some new partnerships that have been formed specifically to address the overrepresentation of communities of color on our streets. And finally, and I think I've said this to you before, but I remain on this last day of sign up incredibly optimistic about the Affordable Care Act, Oregon's healthcare transformation, and what that might mean. In our last count, over half of the homeless people reported having a disabling condition. I mean, like many of you, I've been to a number of meetings, and I still don't know exactly how and when getting coverage will start bringing about a change, but I'm confident that it will. Soon, Home Forward is going to release the results of a study by Providence Center for Research of tenants at the Bud Clark Commons. Those who were Medicaid members, we learned, had a 55% decline in Medicaid costs in the years after moving into Bud Clark Commons. That kind of savings will hopefully be a strong motivation for an insurer to see their members housed. I have to believe that what it means for some people may even mean never becoming homeless, because health care bills won't swamp their budget, and others will have more ability to work and stay stable in their housing because they're receiving care for a mental health condition or able to access detox if they're trying to quit an addiction. And so that is my intro.
So I'm going to spend just a minute on the priorities to performance issues, and then I think we'll go back to Tracy and others for specific discussions of the packages in front of you today. But I wanted, since this is the first time as a council we've gotten together, and I've talked to your individual offices about this project, but what we've done this year and what we're trying to do this year is put a focus on performance and performance metrics throughout sort of the budget process. And by using this budget lens and performance, it's the intent, the ultimate goal here is to provide council with a performance framework as you allocate resources throughout the budget process. In addition, a good performance management system will also communicate our priorities to the public. It makes it very clear to the public, very transparent in terms of the decision-making process that we had and what the expected outcomes of those decisions are. And finally, it increases accountability on the back end of the budget decisions we make by reporting back and showing what the results of those decisions were. So again, what we're trying to do is really shift the city from performance measurement, which is something that we do and something that we actually do a lot of. We track over 600 performance metrics within our budget, but really shift from performance measurement into performance management in terms of using those, actively using those in our decision-making processes. And again, this is based on a lot of best practices by a number of national organizations, and something I think the city has tried at different points, and really we need to do what we can to integrate performance measurement into the budget process. So with that context, you have a separate handout here, and what this shows is what sort of a first take at this process. And what we did this year is to sort of what we call phase one is we, again, took the three priority areas and really focused on those areas instead of doing a broad rollout to see how well we could do in terms of developing the appropriate performance metrics for this area. And we've worked with the bureaus, the lead bureaus in each of those areas that have done an incredible amount of work in a very short period of time to come up with impact measures and key performance indicators. On the very front of this chart, you will see a graph, or I'm sorry, on the very front of the handout, you'll see a graph, and you can see priority at the top. So again, in this case, the priority is homelessness and hunger. Beneath that is an impact measure. And again, what the impact measure does is it measures the overall long-term effectiveness of the city services around that priority. And then beneath that impact measure, you see a number of key performance indicators. And again, this can be, you know, only a couple, or it could be quite a few, depending on the impact area. And the key performance indicators measure the short-term effectiveness and efficiency of specific services that we happen to be funding. and again, I'm going to let Tracy talk about the specifics that, that she and her bureau have come up with for housing. But the goal of this process, again, in these three areas, is to develop impact measures for each of these areas, to begin the process of developing key performance indicators, and then to this next fiscal year, report back on those, have provide quarterly reporting back to council. You'll also see on page three, and actually behind that as well, are drafts of dashboards. And so we've been, again, working with the bureaus to develop a dashboard reporting so that it's a very simple format that'll be coming back to council that'll show, you know, again, remind you of what the impact measure is, and then remind you of what the KPIs and their targets are, and then use some dashboard reporting so that you can really see whether we're making the progress that we expected to make on these things. I do want to stress this is a very iterative process. It's a process that we're working through sort of as we speak. And so what's in front of you today is our best thinking to date. Again, the bureaus have done a really good job, I think, of in a very short period of time taking, and again, these bureaus have been tracking their performance. It's not like this is new to them. But taking those performance metrics they've been tracking and turning them into impact measures and key performance indicators. And what we'd really like to do as we go through this, again, at the beginning of each of these three sessions, we'll talk a little bit about what we've come up with, keeping these things in mind as you go through, and then feedback either during these sessions about the impact measures or KPIs or afterwards. Again, we can make adjustments as we go through. The ultimate goal is to have an impact measure that you as a council all agree on, that is the ultimate impact measure we're trying to reach. And then the key performance indicators can vary a little bit depending on what we fund. If we happen to fund a particular program, we might develop a key performance indicator around that program with some goals and metrics so that we can come back quarterly during the year and say, yeah, we said we were going to increase this by 10%, and in fact, we have exceeded that goal or we've fallen a little short, and why. And that what that does is create that accountability feedback loop between the budget decisions that you're making as a council and the outcomes we're expecting from the bureaus.
Andrew, a question?
Yeah.
How do those performance indicators line up with the performance metrics in the Portland plan?
So it's a great question. And what we did to start this process in terms of defining what the priorities would be and what the impact measures would be, we actually took the 12 measures of success. We haven't developed, and those are actually easy. So complete neighborhoods is one of the three priority areas. Complete neighborhoods already had an impact measure and a number of key performance indicators that we were able to take directly from the Portland plan. The housing, homelessness, and emergency preparedness were not directly linked, but there are things that we were able to pull out, and I know the bureaus have been doing that. Ultimately, to the extent council finds this a useful process as we sort of go through phase one, we'll be expanding it to other service areas in the city and, again, taking those definitely the 12 measures of success and then expanding beyond that as well.
I had to look at the book differently and do my research differently, and that's fine. I'm not objecting to that. But I had a hard time kind of thinking about it in terms of the budget in the future, in the past, and what I was a little bit worried that I would have difficulty figuring out areas of that I might be interested in commenting on, but they wouldn't show up perhaps in the same way. I was a little bit worried about that. So I'm just, through this whole process, I'd love to keep being oriented on what this is all about and how it's expected to improve performance. Just looking at it now, I'm thinking I'd love to know how the impact measure was picked for decreasing homelessness, because I notice it's not eliminate homelessness, or there's a catchphrase that people use all the time around homelessness, end homelessness. And that isn't here. There's another measure that's not quite as ambitious as that. That's a pretty ambitious one. So,
yeah, as you said, this is iterative, and it's a tool. I think it. Stabilization budget is a good time to start using this tool because it's a matter of what's working.
Mm-hmm. So the three areas, are those going to continue into the future?
Probably not. That those were three areas that I put on the table as priorities for me and in this budget process. But I think our ability to focus on a few things each budget process is greater than our ability to look at the whole enterprise. Mm-hmm. So picking a few areas that are either mayoral or council priorities is a good way to start.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, following up on that, you know, one of the things, and it may be a nomenclature issue as well, that we started the process defining what the priorities would be, and we defined over 20 of them. And really, we probably shouldn't have called them priorities. They're service areas or they're, you know, program areas. And really, all of them are important. But one of the sort of best practices in budgeting, particularly in public budgeting, is early in the process, having the mayor and council sort of talk about, well, for this year, are there particular areas we want to focus? We always need to focus on public safety. It's an ongoing thing. We always need to focus on housing and homelessness. Mm-hmm. We always need to focus on transportation and parks every year because those are important core services that the city provides. But in any given year, as the mayor said, we can't necessarily provide additional funding to all of those things. And I think this is a good example of a year where we have a very small amount of excess resources. And the question is, how do we narrow down the $32 million of requests, which could have been $40, $50, or $60 million, in terms of overall, needs that people would like to see? How do we begin to focus that down to something smaller? I think that's the ultimate goal, but the problem with the word priority, and we've been discussing internally, how to sort of change that, is it does make it sound like everything else is not. And I think really everything we're providing is a priority. I mean, all the core services are important to people.
It's like essential and non-essential.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, the question really, these areas will continue, and the performance indicators we come up with will continue to be tracked. But next year, the mayor and council may focus on things that are completely different, and we'll be developing, again, impact measures around those things as well. Mm-hmm. The ultimate goal is that we would actually have impact measures for all of our core service areas so that a citizen, even if it was something council wasn't focusing on, would still be able to look at a particular issue and say, oh, that's what the city's trying to achieve, and here I can track how well they're doing against it.
And I think it's important to note that the mayor's priorities, they're not mine. So there'll be some discussion about other things. I'm wondering about these performance indicators, specifically for housing. There's no measurement on equity and on closing that gap that you just mentioned about communities of color. Could we add a measurement on that?
So that's a great segue. Let me turn it over to Tracy just to talk briefly about sort of the process, of the impact measures and KPIs, and that's good feedback, Commissioner.
Yeah, it's great feedback. So as noted, our impact measure is worded a little carefully. I think as a bureau, we tend to be conservative for starters. We ask CBO, so are you looking for a stretch goal or are you looking for something that feels achievable? But the place that we really struggle with homelessness is the things we do have some success in, actually quite a bit of success in prevention efforts, but that's usually once someone's teetering on the brink of homelessness. The thing that we've learned, if we didn't know before so starkly in the past few years, is we don't control the things, the ultimate forces in our society, the feeders, if you will, to quote Commissioner Fish, of homelessness. So, what we learned was if the economy tanks and people lose their jobs, and at the same time our housing is becoming really unaffordable, our ability as the city to control those forces is fairly nominal, right? That was happening nationwide. So we actually spent a fair amount of time thinking about where's the place that we can advise city council we actually can try to move the needle, as opposed to making commitments to things that frankly are outside of our power. And so this concept of a rate of homelessness was something, first of all, it kind of controls for the population, and it was more conservative in terms of, yes, we strive to end every person's homelessness, we even target populations of homelessness, but tries to acknowledge that we don't control those feeders. That was the concept. I think people could certainly should discuss whether we got that across or not. So sort of within the context of the people who are homeless today, one of the things we also would be interested in thoughts about, and I think it depends on how council wants to use these moving forward, is having key performance indicators that actually would tell the story of that context. So, you know, these are our goals, sort of assuming everything chugs along the way it does. If you have an indicator that shows that unemployment suddenly spikes, what I will tell you is you will see our performance against the rest of our indicators take a dive. So in terms of what will really tell you how we're performing and perhaps where we need to focus, you know, providing you with that information, that may be something we would consider how you add, at least as context. So certainly, Commissioner Fritz, thank you. I think adding an equity indicator would be helpful. And again, I think it's a little bit different in terms of how it's, so these were designed to say how they roll up to the goal. But to me, in terms of what our goals are as a bureau, that speaks very strongly. So I would like to add that.
Tracy, along the lines that you were just talking about, I would be really interested if there is an established correlation between the unemployment rate and the rate of homelessness, for example, to have sort of a context-sensitive number. I mean, if it's something like 35 per 10,000, assuming today's unemployment rate, which would be adjusted on a percentage basis depending on how bad the unemployment rate was, that's right. I mean, if there actually is that correlation, that seems like the right way to measure.
Yep, I mean, I'll just add, you know, in terms of the measure, because, you know, again, we've been working over the last few weeks on this. You know, I originally, when I looked at it, I thought, well, you're decreasing from 37.79 to 35. It didn't feel like a huge stretch. But then I think housing did a really good job of putting it in context that without past public and private, you know, investments, the rate of homelessness would have been three times higher. So it's also worth thinking about, again, we're talking about incremental budget decisions in terms of what to do with the Housing Bureau. I mean, I think the all funds budget for housing is, you know, over $90 million, you know, of money being invested. And I think that's an important component to get across as well, that the homelessness problem would be significantly larger if it wasn't for that investment. What we're talking about in terms of this goal for 2019 is what's the incremental additional we could add that may be able to bring that rate down. Am I right? I mean, that's sort of what we're getting at with the measure.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Thank you.
So on that point, you know, when we do our rate work around our utilities, we throw in data on peer cities. I guess misery loves company, so we want to show where you are with your water bill. In fact, what it shows is that if you move to Tigard and Lake Oswego, for example, you're going to pay more for your water. And I wonder, Tracy, if it would be useful to show some comparative data in other cities, because I think sometimes we get stuck in this cul-de-sac of thinking like Portland's a unique place dealing with homelessness. So you go down to Los Angeles and there's 50,000 unsheltered people. Well, you know, in terms of proportion, the difference in our populations, there's no way to explain that other than they have a much bigger problem than we have. So anyway, I think sometimes those comparators are useful. Katie, to your point about ending homelessness, I wish, and I think it was a Bush, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I wish a prior president named Bush had not conditioned the receipt of federal funding on having a program to end homelessness. Because it actually was never even a program to end homelessness. The fine print said it's a program to end chronic homelessness. And if you end chronic homelessness, the idea was there's more resources available to deal with other kinds of homelessness. So it was never even intended to end homelessness. And so what we've seen in the last year is a bunch of stories locally with people saying, well, we're 8 years, 9 years into a 10-year plan. There are still homeless people. It's obviously a failure. Without looking at the question of who's been served, how have lives changed, and then what's the mix. So that's an example where I think the federal government did us a great disservice in mandating as a condition of getting the resources that we have a 10-year plan, because frankly, we weren't going to end homelessness. We're a little ahead of schedule, so the mayor's given me license to ask a few questions. A couple are big and a couple are small. Yeah, well, he's letting me speak. That's what I'm saying. Number one, in terms of bigger picture, are you, my sense, my recollection is the strategic plan that we did about 4 or 5 years ago has run its course. Are you contemplating updating the strategic plan?
Yes, we have a draft that we're working on that will be complete at least for the Bureau and with the Commissioner's guidance by the end of fiscal year. And I think we had talked about bringing it to Council as a matter of information at a bare minimum, but we're at Council a lot next month, so sometime by June 30, yes.
There's some dire predictions about declining federal resources and TIF resources in the budget submission. So that, of course, begs a question about long-term, how are we going to plug those holes? And what is the impact of declining resources even on the future of the Portland Housing Bureau? Do you have how do we get our hands around that, knowing that we can project that there's going to be declining resources, particularly because of sequestration at the federal level and because of the fact that a lot of TIF has been front-loaded? What's your approach to how you think about whether that money can be replaced, or if not replaced, what's the impact on the Bureau as we know it?
Well, it's obviously something we spend a lot of time worrying about. And I think that, you know, the number one thing that we do is to try to maintain our investments in the city's affordable housing infrastructure. So when we invest in a building, we require 60 years of affordability. So, you know, appropriately or not, I often talk about it as investing in infrastructure in a similar way that other public entities would invest in infrastructure. I don't pretend to know what the depreciation is on a road or a sewer, but 60 years is the number that we've picked. So to go along with that, our best dollar is always invested in preservation, and that's where we continue to focus. All of our first dollar is in preserving the infrastructure that we have. And then secondly, looking at leverage, such as we're doing in the homeless system with the county, such as we do all the time with both private and public investors. Our conservative estimate is $4 public-private for every city dollar that we spend, of course, highly dependent on what the project is. But yeah, I mean, we do a lot of best practice research. We try to keep up with how other communities are funding an ongoing affordable housing agenda.
Tracy, if I could drill down on two of the requests in the package. Under $350,000 ongoing for shelter capacity, and maybe it's clearer in the underlying document, but in the memo that I have, I'm trying to sort this out. Is any portion of that $350,000 proposed to be dedicated to expanding women's shelter? I know we've had this discussion about whether we should have a woman's shelter that goes year-round, or we should expand our existing capacity in women's shelter. Is that part of any of your budget requests?
Not specifically beds for women. So that package is actually two things. And the one relative to shelter, I actually need to give Commissioner Fritz some credit for challenging us to think about as we were doing our decision packages, the programs that have been cut during the last few years of budget cuts that we have no fewer need for those services. We simply had less money. So that package restores cuts to the existing shelter system, which would include the women's shelter system. SAFES, one of our two primary women's shelters, has a larger facility now, and we've been able, particularly during the winter, to get a few more beds out of them, and we'll continue to work with them on that. The biggest expansion is actually the men's winter shelter capacity that we lost in budget cuts 2 years ago. We didn't specifically lose men's shelter capacity. We cut the winter shelter capacity. And so to the degree that we can continue to find a facility that can temporarily house our winter shelter with enough space to separate men and women, this package would restore our ability to do so. It also fills back some other cuts to all of the shelter system. So you see here some things about also trying to relieve bottlenecks and shorten people's stay in shelter, and that's partially about some of the funds that shelters use to move people along more quickly, help with either preventing them needing to come to the shelter in the first place or deposits to get that first home.
And I think it expands 2-1-1 info as well, right, to 24/7 rather than the current hours.
Right. So That's part two of the package, thank you, is 211 Info, as everybody observed, operates full-time during emergencies. So we also consider this part of our contribution to emergency preparedness is that safety off the street. It only has the capacity to operate 24/7 in a very limited way, working with the family system. So we'd like them to also work with the adult system. They work pretty closely with public safety and did, frankly, a tremendous job of coordination during the last severe weather event.
So, you have a fair housing. This is after the upgrade of our technology. You have a fair housing ask, and I know that we can't really talk about the ongoing work, but can you just briefly tell us the one-time $100,000 that you're asking for gets us, why is that important?
I will tell you now, and I'm supposed to tell you again tomorrow, but maybe they can skip my turn tomorrow because I'm here with Dante tomorrow. So that's two separate things. One is working with the city's attempts to really do a better job with our Title VI compliance. For instance, this past year we had our community needs hearing out in East Portland and had a tremendous number of people showing up who did not speak English. And so using interpretation services and using translation services, something that because the Bureau does so much of our work through community partners, we pass along those requirements and certainly those desires, but not any money to get. It's effectively an unfunded mandate at the moment. So trying to create a small pool initially to let our to give our partners capacity to do translation, and then as we move forward, coordinating better with the other bureaus, because I'm sure other people have the same issue. Part two of that ask, more specifically around fair housing, is a pilot with the Community Alliance of Tenants. So right now they do a lot of hotline work, and for some people that is enough of an intervention. They also do referrals also with some of the other partners we fund to do enforcement work where there's really a need for legal assistance. There's a big swath between somebody who a hotline encounter is sufficient and someone who needs legal assistance where some more intensive work and some follow-up on a hotline call might help them. You know, very often it's compose a letter requesting a reasonable accommodation or dealing with a letter that they've received from their landlord. So really it's kind of a prevention, a fair housing prevention strategy to try to keep people from losing housing or sometimes attaining housing, often not even because there's a lack of cooperation, but just because there's a lack of understanding.
Mayor, I just want to say this is the finest presentation I think we've had on housing in the last 5 years. I move that we just adopt the $4.95 million and shorten this whole budget process. Is there a second?
Tracy, could you talk about the $500,000 to prevent and end homelessness for youth? I understand this is part of the package that the mayor has put together with the county and what that would buy.
Absolutely, and would invite the mayor to do the same. So we've, City of Portland has funded a portion of the youth homeless system since 2005, and that funding goes primarily to two things. We pay for about half of the youth short-term shelter and all of the transitional housing. Last year, that was, last couple years, that's been $653,000. As part of the work that was done with the budget with the county last year, this money became one time only. And so it would restore that funding as it works with this year's discussions with the county.
The rest of the package in a few minutes, but that's good.
Tracy, you mentioned leverage earlier as one of your cornerstone values. With the exception of what the mayor is going to talk about vis-a-vis his negotiations with the county chair, are there particular items in your ongoing or one-time ask which you anticipate being matched by the county or whether we could condition on the county matching?
It depends on how you define match. I mean, certainly we're working a lot more closely with the county Short-term rent assistance, which I know the mayor is talking about, has always been a partnership with the county that's really effective. The decision package around preventing and ending homelessness for vulnerable families is something that we're working more and more with behavioral health at the county, with the support of the Portland Police Bureau. It's actually been a great partnership to connect the Police Bureau, County Behavioral Health, and our homeless providers more directly. I think we've talked previously about being able to fund mental health outreach, and that's something that the county has also had an interest in funding. So these packages don't have a direct match, but there's the governance, the new coordinating board for A Home for Everyone will first and foremost take up those issues. So it's a reason for great optimism.
One of the things, Don Wood, who's one of our citizen advisors who was not able to be here today, he's ill, and he sent a number of questions which we forwarded to the Bureau, and we'll be providing responses back that we'll provide to everyone and put out there. But I did just want to follow up on one of his questions, because I think it might tie in with some of the performance stuff. But, you know, he said that as he went through these packages, you know, related to the vulnerable populations and homelessness and so forth, that when dividing sort of the request by the number of people being served, he found that the number was quite high. And one of the things that he asked is there backup data that sort of supports, you know, is that an appropriate amount to be spending for those populations? And is that something you think that will, one, can you sort of address that issue? But then is that something that you think also that we can address as we go through the performance management to sort of look at and track those metrics as well?
Yeah, and I wasn't clear exactly what he was looking at when he commented on that, so I'll need to get some clarification from it. But I mean, I think so. The answer is yes. I think that's an important metric, and perhaps a good example is Decision Package 1, which is preventing and ending homelessness for vulnerable families, disabled adults, and sort of the short-term rent assistance that I know the mayor's proposing, or the women's initiative that we funded earlier. In many ways on the surface really seem like the same thing, right? You're funding outreach workers, you're funding rent assistance, you're funding client assistance, but they do appear to have different costs. And the reason is that, like all people, homeless people are different and they have different needs and barriers. And identifying the right intervention for that person is something we try to give our providers the flexibility to do. So Decision Package 1 is a bit deeper level of assistance. It's specifically targeted at vulnerable people, disabled people, a lot of people experiencing mental health issues. And what we have found through experience is that often takes a number of encounters, so it's a more staff-intensive intervention. It takes more months of rent assistance to generally with this population. What we're trying to do is hook people up with mainstream services, so Medicaid, Social Security disability, if they're eligible for it. Whereas the short-term rent assistance or the women's program, specifically the short-term rent assistance, a lot of those dollars go to prevention, which we find to be an incredibly effective dollar to spend, but is fortunately also usually a little more shallow intervention. That might be a shorter term need, or it may be working with a population that is only recently homeless. We can apply a rapid rehousing. It's a best practice technique. Tends to be aimed at somebody who's just hit the street and usually is economically homeless. And so a shorter term, less expensive intervention will end their homelessness. So sounds like the same program, outreach to homeless people. If you divide number of people we're proposing to serve by total dollar amount, you will, one just sounds expensive, and it's really because it's a somewhat different population. And we probably need to learn how to do a better job of talking about that when we talk about our programs.
Questions, comments, requests on this segment?
You know where to find me.
Good. Thank you. So we're ready to move on to the next section. Anybody need a break before we do?
Well,
I thought I just covered that actually in here. So when we go ahead, we can go ahead and start on the next segment, unless anybody